Leonardo da Vinci and His Super Brain, Deadfulness, by Michael Cox, illustrated by Clarice Goddard, read by Vienna Vance. Introduction. Millions of people know Leonardo da Vinci as the Italian artist who painted the most famous painting in the world, the Mona Lisa. That's miles better. Millions more regard him as the light years ahead of his time, scientific genius, mathematician, and engineer who dreamed up designs for helicopters, tanks, submarines, and terrifically tidy toilets hundreds of years before anyone else ever got around to creating the real thing. Other people think of Leo as the wiser than a think tank full of masterminds who searched for the human soul, drew fantastically beautiful and detailed pictures of the most mysterious and complicated bits of the human body, and was forever trying to work out personkind's place and purpose in our huge and complex universe. What's it all about? Others regard him as the musician who made his own instruments, wrote his own songs, and performed them beautifully in front of awestruck audiences. Dwang, dwang, dwang. And believe it or not, a whole load more people perceive him as an architect, map maker, and town planner who devised astonishing schemes for stunning new super cities, buildings, and waterways. Now, where shall I put the motorway? The astonishing thing is that every one of these people is right. Leonardo was all of these things and more. If they'd had careers, teachers in the 15th century advising him on what job he should go for would have been a complete nightmare. He was fascinated by just about every subject under the sun, not to mention quite a few beyond it. During his 67 years, Leonardo ended up turning his super brain to more projects than most number of people could fit into 100 lifetimes. And in addition to being ace at so many different subjects, Leo also appeared to have everything else going for him. He was incredibly handsome, a snappy dresser, as fit as a fiddle, and really good at stir. In fact, he was said to be so strong that, using just one hand, he could twist a horseshoe out of shape. He was an expert horse rider and a brilliant fencer, but he was also a pacifist, so he never drew a sword in anger, but he did draw quite a few in charcoal. On top of all this, he was a brilliantly witty and entertaining chin-wagger who had opinions and ideas about almost everything, and even more amazingly, he never went to a proper school. In this book, you can find out all sorts of fantastic facts and stunning stories about the man who is generally thought to have been one of the brainiest and most creative people who've ever lived. Like, why he threw a bucket of water over a priest, how he almost scared his dad to death, what he did to make his art teacher give up painting, what he did with human skeletons and lengths of string, how he planned to drown his army. You can also read about his incredible inventions that were hundreds and hundreds of years ahead of their time. There are all sorts of drawing tips from the man himself, a guide on how to paint a masterpiece, and a lesson in how to speak Italian. And if that isn't enough to get you drooly like a dehydrated Doberman, you can also check out what Leo might have written in his legendary lost notebook and find out the great man's innermost thoughts about the world, life, and minestrone soup. Leonardo once said, wanting to know things is natural to all good people, so it's time to jiggle your gray size, engage your thinking tackle, and get the lowdown on Leonardo da Vinci and his super brain. Nature Boy. Leonardo da Vinci was born in Italy at 10:30 p.m. on Saturday, April 15th, 1352, quite near the fortified hilltop village of Vinci. Wow, what an amazing coincidence. Nah, actually da Vinci isn't a surname, it just means he was Leo of Vinci Village. Leonardo's mom, Caterina, was a 16-year-old servant girl, and his dad, Sir Piero da Vinci, was a notary, sort of a solicitor, but without the big flash car and laptop PC. Although she was obviously quite fond of him, Caterina wasn't actually married to Leonardo's dad, and in the year that Leo was born, Sir Piero married another 16-year-old girl called Albiera, who was loads posher than Caterina. Then she, "It's a boy, Florence!" Italy, "Wow!" Then, not all that long after that, Caterina got married to someone far less upmarket than Sir Piero, leaving little Leonardo with his dad and stepmom. "Right, I'm your dad, Sir Piero and wife Albiera, and I'm your dad's wife, and I'm your mom, and I'm your mom's hubby, Caterina and peasant hubby. Happy now, little Leo?" Wah! However, as Sir Piero and his new wife were forever nipping off to nearby Florence on business and whatnot, they had very little time for Leo. So, despite having multiple moms and dads, the little lad eventually ended up spending lots of time with his grandma and grandpa and Vinci and passing his days in the company of his dad's younger brother, Francesco, whose job was to look after the da Vinci family's olive trees, orchards, and vineyards, and spare children. Uncle Francesco, Leonardo, Grandpa, Grandma, Hen, no relation. As Leo grew up, he and Uncle Francesco passed many happy, sun-filled hours wandering around the local area. The village of Vinci overlooks the valley of the River Arno and much of the hilly countryside around is stunningly spectacular, with superb streams, awesome orchards, perfect pools, and wonderful woods. All of this gorgeous natural beauty is said to have deeply affected Leonardo. It gave an appreciation of nature that would remain with him for the rest of his life. As Uncle Francesco checked out the Da Vinci vines and olives, little Leo would constantly be asking his uncle any manner of questions about the cute critters that chirruped and squeaked and grunted in the hills around them. Hey, Spatterfa! Cool clouds! Brill birds! And, Claire, just look at those glowworms! Uncle Francesco, how did they shine like that?
Because God made them that way.
Suffering spaghetti. He nourishes. No, that's not it. I need to know more. Uncle Frank's nice, but he's completely useless in objective scientific analysis.
He's a real bright kid.
Although not a lot is known about Leonardo's childhood, he's generally believed to have been so knocked out by the local landscape that he soon began wandering off on his own, sketching trees, rocks, and animals. One of his earliest drawings is a picture of two ducks on a pool, which he is thought to have drawn somewhere in the vicinity of Vinci. As he grew up,
he certainly quack on the draw.
As he grew up, Leo soon got into the habit of always carrying his pencil and sketch pad with him wherever he went, drawing whatever caught his eye. In much the same way people nowadays carry cameras and are forever snapping splendor for scenery and fascinating folk. Leonardo continued this habit throughout his life. His notebooks were incredibly important to him because they allowed him to record his ideas, questions, and observations about all the amazing stuff he saw and dreamed up while still fresh in his mind. Before it was all replaced by a whole load of amazing new thoughts. Brain alert, all areas except incoming data. Look at the way that bird's taken off. How do oxen feed from tall plants? Hey, I've just had an ace idea for a flying machine. Wow, every heap of sand is twice as wide as its high. Why do dead bodies float? He also began to make notes about the best ways to improve his artistic skills. Here's what he said about making rapid sketches of people. Learning with Leo. Speed drawing people. Quickly draw the main lines their bodies make, but ensure you keep it simple. Do it over the head and straight or curved lines for the legs, arms, and trunk. Main body, nothing to do with elephants. Then, when you get home, finish off your sketches properly. Developing rapid hand-eye coordination. Make some silhouettes out of cardboard in different shapes, then throw them from a high place and quickly draw the various movements and new shapes they make at several points during their fun. This will improve your hand-eye coordination no end. Claire, the things I do for art. It wasn't just drawing that young Leonardo became good at as he grew up in the Tuscan countryside. By the time he was a teenager, he'd become a dab hand at decoration, too. The story of Leonardo's stunningly scary shield. One of the peasants on the Da Vinci estate carved himself a shield out of wood from a fig tree. He fancied getting it decorated, so he took it to Ser Piero. Could you get this decorated by one of them, their posh painters? In Florence, boss, I'll make it worth your while. No problem, but it'll cost you a trout and a wild bear. Crafty Ser Piero immediately passed the shield to Leonardo. Decorate this manky shield, will you, son? Sure, Dad, no problem. The shield was a right dog's dinner, all warped and manky. But being a practical lad, Leonardo straightened it up, got it polished, then covered it in his own super-duper varnish. This is fun, I love a challenge. He then set about thinking up a suitably scary image to go on it. For inspiration, he collected a load of dead lizards, bats, crickets, and snakes, and other weird creepy crawlies. Yeah, really gross. Next, he cut up all the parallel critters and did a mix-and-match job until he created a real nightmare of a monster. Gorgeous! Then he painted a picture of the monster on the shield and he set it in the corner of his workshop so that a dramatic shaft of light fell on it, making it look more scary and lifelike than ever. Dad, come and see this! The moment his dad clapped eyes on the shield, he was terrified. It's horrible! Well, there's no point in having a shield unless it's scary. Instead of giving that shield to the peasant, the dodgy notary went to the market and bought him a cheap replacement.
There you go, Mario.
Le grazie, Ser Piero, it's brill. He then took Leonardo's super shield to a merchant and flogged it to him for heaps of dosh.
Ooh, very nice.
And then the merchant took the shield to the Duke of Milan himself and flogged it to him for a small fortune. Well, never trust a solicitor. Learning with Leo. Feeding your imagination. In order to stimulate your imagination and get yourself feeling really creative and bursting with ideas, look at a bed covered with shapeless stains. If you look hard enough, you will see fabulous mountain landscapes, terrific trees, bloody battles, fantastic faces, and strange costumes. On the other hand, if you're hopelessly unimaginative, you'll probably see a bed covered with shapeless stains. Yep. So Leonardo continued growing up and wandering around the sunny Tuscan countryside eating lots of minestrone soup, his favorite nosh, being constantly fascinated by the never-ending mysteries of science and nature, and no doubt dabbling in lots more art projects and whatnot. During this time, it's generally believed that rather than going to school like kids do nowadays and swatting for his SATs, Leonardo was educated by the local priest, who taught him important stuff like not to chew the end of his quill, the three R's, and why it's not a good idea to blow your nose whilst shaking hands with a nobleman. Excuse me, Holy Father, why are grapes grape-shaped, and why are sheep lily? Oh yes, and how do glowworms glow? Grapes, he's worse than Uncle Francisco. Because God made them all that way, my son. Heavens above, this kid never stops. And then, around the time Leo was getting pippas the size of Mount Vesuvius and sprouting hair in really scary places, his dad decided to move from Vinci permanently and take his super bright son with him. So at the age of 15 or thereabouts, Leonardo da Vinci, whiz kid and world-famous hairy genius in the making, flitted to the most happening and exciting city in all of 15th century Europe. Fabulous Florence. The rip-roaring Renaissance. Depending on which century you happen to be living in, Florence is a day's gentle donkey ride or an hour's terrifying taxi trip from the village of Vinci. Cough, cough. Taxi ride. Florence had once been a dangerous and disease-ridden place, but by the time Leonardo and his dad moved there, it had become a fabulously wealthy city, buzzing with excitement, activity, new ideas, and really big mosquitoes. It was filled with mega-rich merchants and all kinds of terrifically talented creative types, and you couldn't walk 5 meters without tripping over an artistic genius or bumping into a big cheese businessman. As a result, much of the civilized world regarded Florence as the most happening, cutting-edge, where it's at city on Earth. Florence. There ain't nothing like a dome. Giotto's Campano. The Cathedral. Not in Florence. Palazzo Vecchio. Horse races. Cheer! Rare snarl. Hooray! Organized fights between wild beasts. Archery. Jesting. River Arno. Just one Cornetto. One of the main reasons Florence and one or two other European cities were regarded as such happening places was that during the century or so preceding Leonardo's birth, a big change had begun to take place in Europe, and it affected the ways in which people thought, behaved, and lived their daily lives. This big change is now known as the all-doing, all-thinking, all-inquiring, rollicking, rip-roaring Renaissance. In order to understand how Leonardo played his part in this accelerating era of learning and creativity, you may find the following guide helpful. Rough Guide to the Renaissance. Around about 500 AD, after the ancient Roman Empire had collapsed, all sorts of wild and smelly barbarian tribes began rushing around Europe, generally being vulgar, violent, and disagreeable. During this turbulent period in history, fisticuffs, famine, and fecklessness were widespread in Western Europe and through the Middle Ages, as they later became known. Mom, the Vandals are smashing up the chariot shelter again! Scratch. Shut up and drink your slime! The Middle Ages, or medieval times, as they're sometimes called, were all gloom and doom, though, and when the barbarians settled down a bit, some really cool art was created, including groovy Gothic cathedrals, superb stained glass, tasteful tapestries, and magnificent manuscripts. And what's more, universities, hospitals, and banks were all medieval inventions. But generally speaking, people were superstitious and ignorant, and things relating to human progress and well-being just didn't tootle along at the rate they did in some other eras. The Middle Ages lasted until around the 13th century, when, comparatively speaking, things began to look up. Certain pieces, especially northern Italy and the Low Countries, now known as Holland and Belgium, started to become prosperous and peaceful. The smell of the atmosphere led to the arrival of a new age of discovery and creativity, which was eventually named after the French word meaning rebirth. In other words, the Renaissance! The Renaissance is now regarded as one of the most important times in European history because it was when thousands of ignorant, nose-picking, tire-kicking thickwits were transformed into educated, enlightened, sensitive types who were just fizzing with need-to-know, can't-wait-until-tomorrow interest and excitement about the world they lived in. Previously, people had thought things like, oh, well, life on Earth might be out of pants, but at least we can look forward to going to heaven when we pop our clogs. Yes, just as long as we avoid sin, we'll all be fine. But during the Renaissance, people started thinking things like, wow, ain't the world we live in an amazing and fascinating place? Not half. Let's live for today and party. I want to discover as much as I can about the world around me. Car on feet, brilliant. So all of a sudden, learning, inquiry, and discovery became the new stupidity, apathy, and ignorance. And this is what happened next. One, Renaissance brainy types began looking back to the days of the ancient Greek and Roman civilizations and said things like, those ancients knew a thing or two. Not half. Maybe we could learn stuff from them. Two, scholars began to be influenced by what the wise bards of days gone by had written about politics, life, and law, while arty types began to take long and thoughtful quizzes at classic club plays, poetry, sculpture, and architecture, and were inspired to create great new art of their own. Wow, look at the six-pack on him! Three, artists began to have new thoughts about the way they made their art and what their art said about their subjects. Hey, aren't human bodies beautiful? Not half! Let's make our art celebrate what glorious things human beings are. Yes, let's make our new modern state-of-the-art paintings more realistic looking. The ordinary folk would be more interested in them because they will see people, just like themselves. Aren't feet brilliant? There. There was a real spirit of inquiry in the air. Suddenly, people wanted to know everything about everything. Science, history, nature, art. Stuff like, is the world really sausage-shaped? Does putting goose dung on your head really cure buns? How do you draw noses so that they look 3D? Does our blood really burn inside us to keep us warm? Five, as well as finding out about their immediate world, they were also desperate to find out about the great big world that lay beyond their own front doorsteps. Explorers such as Vasco da Gama, Ferdinand Magellan, and Christopher Columbus weighed anchor and set sail to discover the astonishing places that lay over the horizon. What shall we do with the drunken sailor? Land ahoy! Collar! Look at all those people in feathered headdresses and their strange conical animal skin tents. So where do you think we are, Chris? India, of course, dimwit. Six. Merchants got really busy buying and selling things, often to and from people living in the countries that had been discovered by the seafarers. People who lived in the towns and cities became much better off. They wanted to spend their dosh on all the fancy goods that were arriving from far-off places. As a result, the wheeling-dealing merchants grew really rich. Nice bit of silk that, squire! Fell off the back of a camel! Which meant they had stacks of spare cash to spend on art, architecture, and sculpture. Especially art and stuff dedicated to the glory of God, because it made them feel far less guilty about being so ridiculously rich. 7. In the middle of the 15th century, Johannes Gutenberg developed Europe's first printing press in Germany. Before this, books had been few and far between because they'd been written out by hand, just one at a time. By the time Leonardo was in his late 30s, there were about 1,000 printing presses operating in Europe. This gave lots more people the opportunity to learn to read and write. Astoundingly smart, talented, and inquisitive, young Leonardo couldn't have wished for a better time or a better place to begin his career as all-around genius than 15th century Florence. Leonardo's Lost Notebook, 1369. March. My country bumpkin days are finally over. I have moved to the wonderful city of Florence. This place is huge and is teeming with all kinds of interesting people, many of them dressed in fine clothes and riding lovely horses. All a great feast for my eager eyes. I love horses. There are educated and talented creative types all over this fine city, and many from far lands, too, all here to do business and admire the great art. Yesterday, I saw the fantastic dome on the cathedral, designed by our great Florentine genius, Brunelleschi, cupola of the Duomo. There's so much to take in here that my brain is positively fizzing with excitement. I also saw one of the Medici yesterday, probably Lorenzo. They're the top family here in Florence. Papa does work for them and says they're definitely the guys to be in with. They're very wealthy. April. Papa has decided it's time I learned something useful. What am I to do? Mom and Papa weren't married, so I'm not allowed to be a solicitor, or a banker, or a doctor, or pharmacist, so there's no point in me going to Florence only to learn Latin, geometry, and law. Instead, Papa's arranged for me to train to be an artist at one of the most creative hothouses in the city, the studio of Andrea Cavaraccio. I will be living there with ordinary young men, the sons of butchers, bakers, and pasta makers, which suits me fine just as long as I'm learning and drawing and being creative. And I'm not all bothered about not being taught about geometry and things. I can find out about those things for myself later on. I start at these tomorrow. Can't wait. Get in the know at Studio Verrocchio. When it came to knocking out awesome art, Andrea del Verrocchio was the bee's knees. Bigwigs and hotshots from far and wide came to his studio to commission all manner of magnificent masterworks. Verrocchio's. The finer things in life have frescoes, furniture, sculptures and paintings, cool carvings, memorials, banners, and coats of arms. Gorgeous goblets and salvers, gold or silver on request. Macho military machines and armor. Yes, we have God of the Lotta. Plus some terrific terracotta. You commission it, we make it. No job but too big or small. Andrea del Verrocchio, 1335 to 1388. When Andrea was a young lad, something happened that was to affect him for the rest of his life. One day he and his pals were larping about, chucking lumps of rock when a stone he'd thrown accidentally hit another boy on the head. Unfortunately, the stone killed the lad and Andrea was arrested for murder. However, after a few weeks in prison, he was let out. Accidental deaths were very common in Florence in those days. But the memory of this terrible tragedy remained. Many years later, when he was working on a sculpture of David, the sure shot who slew Goliath, he gave him a sword instead of a stone and sling because he felt so bad about his terrible misdeed.
What do you mean you thought a feather duster would look much nicer than a sling and stone?
When Andrea grew up, he became a goldsmith's apprentice and learned to do all sorts of snazzy stuff, including carving precious stones, designing jewelry, and working with molten metals. He eventually became a sculptor and painter, and in 1364, he got the job of making a tombstone for one of the mega-rich and all-powerful Medici family. It was the big break he needed. After that, he became their official sculptor. Jobs came pouring in, and his business really took off. Verrocchio's Workshop. Verrocchio's studio on Lamb Street in Florence was a hive of activity with artists and apprentices all working their socks off. In those days, artists weren't the trendy, windbag, no-talent posers that some are reputed to be nowadays, but were real hard-grafting craftsmen who had to learn every skill and trick of their trade in a long and arduous apprenticeship that could last for up to 10 years. And artists' studios weren't the pretentious, no-talent poser hangouts that some are reputed to be nowadays, but were more like top-notch factories where teams of skilled and dedicated craftsmen turned out beautiful art that was meant to be admired and to last for all eternity. Sculpture, botanical study, portraiture, perspective study, drying dyed fabrics, preparing panels for painting, grinding and mixing pigments. The daily grind. There were similar artist studios like Verrocchio's on almost every street in Florence, and in every one of them young men like Leonardo were learning skills such as drawing, painting, sculpting, and goldsmithing. During their first year at these studios, the lads were known as disciples and were generally treated as dogs' bodies who fetched and carried for the later artists. Amongst their duties, they were